in the mood of the fallen leaf. One vodka appeared one day. He had come from the land of spirit.
That was Redbone, one of the great rock and roll groups of our history, the first major Native American rock and roll group in this country, celebrating the birthday of its band members today. And that was Wovoka, or one of their more political songs, standing up to the oppression of Native people in this country. We are about to have a conversation with John Cavanaugh, director of the Institute for Policy Studies, Sarah Anderson, Global Economy Project Director at the Institute, and Tiffany Williams, Advocacy Director for Break the Chain Campaign at the Institute for Policy Studies. John, Sarah, Tiffany, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Great to be with you.
Good morning.
Good morning. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Of course, jump onto our Facebook pages, and we will see what you have to say there, both on Mark Steiner page and on the Mark Steiner Show page. 410-319-8888. John, it's good to have you all with us this morning. I start with John just because you are the executive director of the Institute for Policy Studies. They've been there for 15 years. The institution itself has been around for 50. So take us on a very quick history tour of IPS and why it is so critical.
Sure. No, thanks, Mark. And as I listen to you go through what happened on this day through history, the one that jumped out as a kind of marker for the Institute for Policy Studies was John Lennon writing the song Imagine. the Institute is Imagine, if you will. But the piece of history, and many of your listeners know this period well, it was created in 1963, and we've just been celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Great March on Washington by Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. But it was created by two people, one of whom is still there today, Mark Raskin, whose son, Jamie Raskin, is one of the great state senators of Maryland. And the other was Dick Barnett, and they were both in the Kennedy administration. And they both, at a certain point, became appalled at how the voices of the poorer half of people in this country and in the world never made it into policymaking. So they created a place that would be independent of government. Never in our bylaws, we don't take money from government. That would speak truth to power, and that also had a very specific niche, and it remains our niche 50 years later, which is that we believe that most positive social change comes from social movement, civil rights movement, women's movement, gay lesbian movement, environmental movement, and so on. And those movements, if equipped with good facts, good analysis, books, and so on, can be very powerful and can make change. So the history of the Institute is really a history starting with the anti-Vietnam War movement, coming up to the present, of IPS playing that role. And, I mean, just to take for a moment, we were always edgy. On Vietnam, we did something called the Vietnam Reader that was used in teach-ins all over the country. But we also did a document, which was a call to resist illegitimate authority, that encouraged people not to go forward with the draft. And because of that, and this is the other thing that I think it's important about our history, because of that, when Richard Nixon became president, we were put on his enemies list, we were infiltrated by the FBI, we were spied upon, and we have had a history of fighting for the right things no matter what. I mean, if it meant civil disobedience, we did civil disobedience, but speaking truth to power and doing it with those powerful social movements.
And we were thinking about talking about this the other night as well. I remember also a little quick anecdotal story about IPS when I was a student there, as a disclaimer, and it's to have also complete transparency here, which is not the reason we're doing this. But in 1967 and 68, during the rebellion in Washington, D.C., after Martin Luther King was killed, the Institute for Policy Studies played a key role in taking in families who were burned out, who were running from the violence and the police, and in providing help to people who needed help when they were confronted and arrested by the police. The IPS played a critical role in that, and I remember that very well, having gone back and forth in between the IPS at that point and the streets itself. So that was a little piece of history people don't realize IPS was involved in as well. Art Waskow was deeply involved in that back in 67, one of the early people there at IPS. But I mean, one of the things we talked about on the phone the other day, John, I think it's important to kind of get into as we also look at, together maybe for a little bit at the crisis America is facing now, are the ways in which you pointed out how progressives won four really important victories and what organizing it took place. And I think, Tiffany Williams, I mean, you were deeply involved in pieces of this, all of you were, but you were in terms of I think you were involved in the campaign around the kind of rights of 1.9 million workers in America. Could you talk a bit about that and how that changed things?
Absolutely. So in the original Fair Labor Standards Act that was passed in 1938, domestic workers were excluded from those protections of minimum wage and overtime. And in 1974, the act was amended to include some domestic workers, but not all of them. And what happened this month was that President Obama and the Department of Labor fixed the regulation to ensure that people who are providing really important care work in the home, so caring for people with disabilities and senior citizens, would be covered by minimum wage and overtime. And the reason that that's important is because every 8 seconds, someone in the U.S. turns 65, and our concept of care has really changed over the years. So what we're seeing now is more people with disabilities and senior citizens want to and are able to stay in their homes and communities and be part of that versus going to hospitals or institutions. And the care workers, those people who are providing those services, are the ones who are making that happen. But for these many years, they've been excluded from minimum wage and overtime protections just simply because the way the law was written. So what happened was that this regulatory change that enabled them to get access to those important protections.
And I think one of the things that's important to talk about here as well is that in organizations like this, folks, and first we want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. We've had the National Domestic Workers Alliance on this program. We've had Jobs with Justice on this program before in the last couple of years. And I think one of the critical pieces here is that the IPS, as for want of a better term, as kind of an intellectual think tank, a place where people write policy, push policy ideas, raise stuff with the American public. This kind of alliance between organizations like the National Domestic Workers Alliance of workers, an interracial group of workers across America, that's key to this because it's a synergy that here really didn't exist in any deep ways, Tiffany.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's where we consider our role is to really provide that the information, the research, the writing, the policy work to help fuel these movements. I think that sometimes they just need the tools and the connections that we're able to provide, especially because we're a multi-issue think tank. We're able to really bring together some of our other projects and with each different thing that we're working on. So, for example, in this campaign, one of the things that we are working on is how do we make this care affordable, right? We're increasing the wages for the workers, so what are we going to do to help families be able to afford that? And so using our connections at IPS, we're able to connect economy experts and tax experts to try to figure out a solution to that particular challenge.
And I think the little things we don't even realize, I think a couple of ways that how progressives kind of unified in ways that papers, most mainstream papers didn't cover or even think about in terms of pushing back certain decisions that were onerous to people. And we don't think about this, like Larry Summers not getting the position he wanted. And say, Anderson, why don't you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Mark, and thanks for giving us this opportunity to talk about something positive for a change and to report on some of these recent victories. I tell you, they don't come very often, and so it's so important to take a moment to celebrate and analyze everything that went into them. And the Larry Summers story was so many years in coming. Oh, my goodness, I've been working on, you know, critiquing Larry Summers for decades now, back to when he was the World Bank chief economist 20 years ago, I think. And so, but to help people understand why this recent thing was significant, so Larry Summers was a high-level official in the Clinton administration. He was Treasury Secretary. He was also part of Obama's inner circle. And he had a dream of becoming the chair of the Federal Reserve Board, which is arguably the most powerful economic position in the world. And he was attacked by many on the left who'd seen him over the years failing upwards. Every time he did something where he screwed up, he managed to get promoted. And the thing that really got people was that he was, in the Clinton administration, part of this clique of economists who pushed for the financial deregulation that laid the groundwork for the crash in 2008. So he was out there pushing for the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was a protection that prevented commercial banks from playing around in the gambling with people's deposits. He was out there pushing for deregulation of the derivatives trading. That's a big part of the whole financial casino. And yet he continued to have so much power in the Obama administration. And so that part of his record of financial deregulation became the core issue that was raised up in this fight. And women's groups spoke out about his record on women's issues, and hundreds of economists came out and signed letters in opposition to his nomination to be Fed chair. And in the end, Obama decided, Larry Summers actually withdrew because the writing was really on the wall that he was not going to get approved by the Senate because Democrats were not going to be united in supporting him. And the reason I think it's significant is I think many people are seeing this as really the first blow to that whole clique of economists from the Clinton era. Robert Rubin was one of the most prominent, the first rejection of them, and the first time they were really called out for their role in the financial crisis.
So, and these things are important to hear because people think, when you look at what's going on Capitol Hill now, and we'll talk about it in a minute, and what role people are playing in what's happening now on Capitol Hill with the shutdown of the government, that people's organizations across the country have no power or effect, that they're isolated, that they can't kind of make their voices heard, and because it's not something you see in the mainstream press at all. And I think one of the things you talked about, John Cavanaugh, on the phone was something we also don't think about very much, which is one of the underpinnings of why we did not attack Syria.
Sure, yeah, and I think I think as Sarah and Tiffany were saying, there's some bigger lessons we can draw from this. But in the piece that we did together on these four victories, the other one we highlighted was Syria, and Syria is one where, I mean, many people who listen to your show were involved in anti-war movements opposing the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq, which we couldn't stop. Massive street demonstrations, we couldn't stop them. This time around, when President Obama decided in late August that he wanted to strike Syria militarily after evidence came out of chemical weapons use in that country, this time the peace movement mobilized, but I think in a more intelligent way. Instead of saying, let's have massive street demonstrations, they said, look, let's put heavy pressure on Congress to try it, and in particular key members of Congress who would have power in this decision to get them to say no to Obama. So the peace movement focused on that. As Obama heard more and more pressure, he felt the need to turn to Congress. He was originally going to strike Syria just on his own. Members of Congress started saying, you can't do this. You don't have the power to do this. Congress is the only body that can declare war. And he threw it back to Congress. And at that point, peace movement, including religious groups, including groups like Peace Action, Code Pink, and so on, really turned up the pressure. And in town meetings all over the country, members were met with overwhelming opposition. Now, just like with Larry Summers, and this is important for progressives, there was also attacks coming from the right, people who hated Obama and who were also mobilizing and pushing Republican members of Congress to come out against a strike in Syria, against Larry Summers. So in both of those instances, it was smart, strategic work by progressives, but that was combined with outrage on the right. and two very bad things, you know, strikes against Syria and Larry Summers were stopped. And I just want to distinguish for a second that from the victory that Tiffany described. I mean, Tiffany described a brilliant long-term strategy to get the Labor Department to give worker rights to 2 million home health care workers. That was years of organizing, but also it was clever. We knew we couldn't win in a gridlocked Congress, so instead we looked carefully. I remember Tiffany bringing domestic workers into the Labor Department right when Obama was elected and Hilda Solis was made Labor Secretary, and saying, where are there rule changes that we can advocate and push for, which, if passed, could give rights to millions of workers? So all of these are cases of progressives becoming much smarter, but some of them depend on also the power of the right, I mean, these unholy alliances. Others of them, like the fight for worker rights, requires just years and years of patient work and struggle.
We're going to take a very brief break and come right back. And when we do return, we're going to kind of tackle what the IPS is working on now on the 50th anniversary coming up, and also what we think might be the effect that people can have on what we face in America right now. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Keep on pushing. Keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. I can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way or somehow. 'Cause I've got my strength, and it don't make sense not to keep on pushing.
John Lennon, Imagine, song released on this day in 1971. And we talk about what we can imagine for a new America. Romani, on the way back to the conversation, the support for WEAA is provided by in-kind donations from Organo Gold Gourmet Coffee, a health and wellness coffee. Selections include mocha, lattes, black, Jamaica Blue Mountain, and King of Coffee. Organic green and red teas are also available. Information at 410-262-5122. That's 410-262-5122. We continue our conversation with the folks from the Institute for Policy Studies today. John Kavanaugh, director of the Institute for Policy Studies. Sarah Anderson, who is the project director for Global Economy. And Tiffany Williams, advocacy director of Breaking the Chain Campaign. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Go onto our Facebook pages and throw your ideas and thoughts up there. We look forward to hearing them. But, as I was looking at this, and I know that there's a huge weekend coming up that I'm looking forward to at the Institute for Policy Studies this weekend with folks from around the country and the world coming in to talk about what the progressive agenda for America could be and how to get there. When you see a couple of things in America, I'm just curious how you think about where we go as a society, as a culture, as a political movement. And folks, please give us your thoughts at 410-319-8888. But when you see, let's just take what's happening right now in front of the Supreme Court, which is not a legislative issue, though it derives itself from legislative issues. And you see that this McCutcheon case is coming up that could, like, unleash all the money, take all the bars off the limits people can contribute to campaigns and allow the wealthy to do whatever they want when it comes to political campaigns. You add that with Citizens United and what that did to voting in America, and then you top that with what happened with voting rights and the gutting of the voting rights bill that has allowed very conservative right-wing legislatures in this country to, and you'll see more abrogating of people of color's rights to vote in America and others as well. So when you talk about a kind of a larger view of where, how people respond to this, because this is where people feel hopeless in many ways, looking at things like that, and what do you do to stop that? And going along with that was the gerrymandering that allows a minority of people in America to kind of hold the U.S. hostage, as is happening now with this government shutdown. So, I mean, whoever wants to join in first, I mean, Sarah, do you want to jump in first? I mean, so what do we say, how do we address those things as a kind of a larger group, as a larger movement?
Well, I can totally understand people who feel demoralized by the power of big money over our political system. And when you look at the numbers of dollars going into lobbying, going into the campaign contributions, you do have to wonder, how can the voices of the people get through in this system? And so we need to fight things like Citizens United, and there are a number of groups we work with who are fighting hard to abolish that. But at the same time, I think we also need to be more clever in our strategies and make all of the money that corporations are putting into the system a liability, shame them, make it embarrassing for politicians to take stands that are connected to the sources of their money. And I think we can see examples of that. The other issue that we raised in our article about the four recent progressive victories has to do with CEO pay. This was something that was passed in the financial reform legislation a few years ago that would require companies to report the gaps between their CEO and worker pay. It gets at the heart of the inequality issue in this country that the Occupy Wall Street activists brought up so effectively. And corporate lobby groups have worked for 3 years to get that CEO to worker pay reporting requirement repealed or watered down. They've used, you know, threats of lawsuits. They've tried to stifle the regulators. And yet the SEC the other day took action towards making this real and beating back this tremendous backlash from the corporate lobby groups. And why? I think it's because people have spoken. I've been reading the comments to the SEC today by ordinary people around the country. 20,000 people wrote to the SEC, people who are working at McDonald's, people who saw their retirements gutted in the financial crisis, people who are still struggling to recover from the economic crisis, and really raising up those ordinary voices. And I think that while we work to fight these huge obstacles like Citizens United and the current Supreme Court case, we also need to find new ways to lift up the voices of ordinary people in ways that really shame our officials into doing the right thing.
And Mark, if this is John,
John, go ahead.
On the theme of imagine that in Switzerland this fall, they're going to pass legislation that will cap what a CEO can make at 12 times what the average worker and his company makes. Sarah's done these studies for 20 years that show CEO pay in this country now well over 300 times average worker's pay. We see, I mean, and I think this is a key role for IPS. We help people imagine what a more equal society could be like, what a more ecologically sustainable society could look like, and what the U.S. and the world as a good neighbor as opposed to an empire could look like, and then offer steps towards it. And a centerpiece of our program right now, and thousands of groups are working on this across the country, is a fair taxation agenda that fairly taxes Wall Street, the wealthy, and corporations, which also counters the whole right-wing narrative that America's broke. There's plenty of money, and that also would tax pollution. Let's tax the bads. And there's plenty of money that would simultaneously make this a more equal country and pay for the sorts of things like Tiffany was talking about, helping poorer, older people pay for home care.
So how do you see that being, I mean, galvanized and organized, though, in America? I mean, this is when you look at this, the victories you outline, I think, were critical steps in kind of changing the face of the country, the face of who we are. Of pushing the legislature, but given The last week when Katrina Vandenhoeven was on this program with others talking about the government shutdown and what it meant, it was clear that things like the kind of gerrymandering of districts and what happens to our electoral system has pushed people to the brink of almost despair when it comes to the electoral process, because they see it so – because it's just become the playing field that people feel is not the people's anymore. They have no control.
Well, you know, it'd be interesting for Tiffany to say a word about this, because our theory at IPS is that powerful social movements can counter what you've just described. And I think most of your listeners know the giant U.S. labor movement, the people who brought you The Weeknd, the big environmental movement, the people who brought you the Clean Air and Clean Water Act. But what we feel, where we're putting much more of our energy at IPS, is the emergence of new national organizing group, which many of your listeners probably haven't heard of, groups like National People's Action, Jobs with Justice, National Domestic Workers Alliance, which have become national and which are posing a bold national agenda. And Tiffany works closest with two of these, the National Domestic Workers Alliance and Jobs with Justice. And I think it'd be good if you could say a word on why we think these can develop the power to challenge the things Mark's describing.
Well, I mean, I think that the despair is still there for sure, but I think what really counters it is that the feeling of, I mean, with domestic workers in particular, because it's mostly women, we do have a very strong care, love, and sisterhood basis, but it's really powerful because you can see yourself in the other people that you're organizing, and you can really see whenever we do have a victory, we take a minute, we take the time to really celebrate it, to analyze it, to figure out how we did it. And so, you know, recently we just won the California Domestic Worker Bill of Rights for domestic workers over in California, and the celebration was incredible. Same with the home care workers' victory. We're really just taking the time to take every victory in, and I think that whenever we do succeed, it really just builds this momentum to keep going. I think the electoral process is difficult, but luckily, organizing and the power that comes from that, and the emotions that come from that. Can be independent of the electoral results. I think that most important is that people feel that sense that they're being heard, that they're being listened to, that they can help others, they can reach others. And in organizing people who don't even have the right to officially form unions, we're reaching people who have been ignored for years.
410-319-8888 name here. Your thoughts on what you're hearing today. Let's go to Bruce in Baltimore. You're on the air. 410-319-8888. Welcome, Bruce.
Yeah.
Hi, how you doing, Mark?
Very well.
You know, I'm laughing again. It's hilarious. So to a certain extent, some of the progressive ideas I agree with, but I've become much more social conservative. So, you know, it's absolutely ridiculous. So you keep talking about gerrymandering. This is the second time a day ago, you mentioned about gerrymandering. And the Republicans have done this, and I don't like it. It's wrong. But if you're paying attention, if you're being honest, you know and understand that the Maryland state legislature did the same thing, gerrymandered the districts so that certain Democrats could be elected, and it was – in particular, to get rid of one representative out in Western Maryland. So let's be honest, Mark.
No,
it's wrong to...
I agree with you, Bruce. I'm not putting this just on the plate of the Democrats when I said that last week or this week, and I think that the state of Maryland that we're broadcasting from is an example of kind of the worst of gerrymandering, whether it was what took place here going after a Democratic congressman that the government didn't particularly like and tried to make his district look ridiculous, or getting rid of Bartlett from Western Maryland, who's a kind of iconoclastic conservative congressman who was a really interesting guy that his district loved. I mean, I think you're right. I think that if you look at the gerrymandering, what's going on in this country, it does not. We have created a Congress that does not represent the will of the people of this country or how this country thinks, no matter what your political perspective is. And I think that I would never kind of just lay that at the doorstep of Republicans. It just so happens that right now in states across America that are run by Republican governors and legislators, that they have done incredible, horrendous gerrymandering to move people of color out, to take poor people out of the right to vote. And those are glaring, but I think it goes across the board. I wouldn't disagree with you at all. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go back to the phones. And Michael, you're on the air.
Yes, Mark, I have three questions for the panel. Quick ones. Number one, for an organization, would you rather have one person do 100% of the work or 100 people do 1% of the work? Would you rather be a leader of the organization or a follower? Would you rather have ownership or would you rather have lending where you just lend or loan your labor? My real question is, why wouldn't you want that to happen in business where a person who could be a leader of 100 people, each one doing 1% of the work, could be exceptionally well paid if he has the leadership to accomplish all that?
This is John. I mean, just a quick response to that. Clearly, our philosophy in our work at the Institute for Policy Studies is that the more people who are organized, and we wouldn't call them followers. I mean, the sorts of groups we're describing here, like the National Domestic Workers Alliance, are empowering its members to be leaders. So it is a very new model. But the only way we will beat the power of money that is behind the gerrymandering of districts and so on is by mobilizing and engaging millions and millions of people. And I think what I like about this new era and the new generation of leaders, people like Ai-Jen Poo, who's leading the National Domestic Workers Alliance, and Sarita Gupta at Jobs with Justice, is that, and Tiffany and Sarah at the Institute for Policy Studies, is that they're breaking down traditional ideas of what we're organizing for. This campaign that Tiffany described is a campaign for intergenerational respect, respecting our elders, making sure they have the resources they need to live in dignity as they get older. It's about love. So there are new concepts. It's not just, you know, worker rights and fairness and so on. And a lot of these movements also have put the planet and ecology at the center. So we're totally in the mode of the, our only chance for transforming this country is if we mobilize millions of people around an agenda for peace, justice, and the environment, and turn them all into leaders.
Yeah, I think that's an important part. I think people forget that when you're, what our caller was just saying, that when companies are built, there may be an entrepreneurial spirit among somebody to build a company in some instances, but without the workers around to make the company work, it doesn't function.
Yeah, so, exactly. You know, one, I do want to say, because this gets also to where Sarah was going as well, we believe that a key to the transformation of this country is part of the way you take on the big corporations that crashed the economy and corrupted our politics is by really encouraging alternative business models as well. And in Maryland, we salute the work of people like State Senator Jamie Raskin pushing for benefit corporations, pushing worker-owned co-ops, pushing new forms of businesses that can help build a new economy that's good for people and the planet, and that in the process of doing so displace the power of the big corporations, both the political and the economic power of the big corporations.
You know, I agree. Maryland has a chance to do things other states haven't, just because of the political nature of the state. And I wonder, Sarah, again, you know, when we're going to talk in the next hour a little bit about TPP and what's going on. And again, people feel like they can't affect this, but I think people do affect that change. It's just that it's not covered by a lot of what's going on. So when you look at this kind of the global picture of the world economy and the interlocking worlds of the kind of the largest capitalist corporations, how do we respond to that?
Well, you mentioned the TPP, which I should spell out is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which
right.
is the trade negotiations going on between the U.S. and 11 other countries. And we've been very disappointed with President Obama on his trade agenda, because when he was campaigning for president, he made all kinds of promises about how he was going to change the U.S. approach on trade and really put workers first and limit the power of corporations to sue governments, which they can now do under agreements like the NAFTA model that was set by the Clinton administration. But since coming into office, the trade negotiators over there have just carried on as though there has been no change in the administration and are still pushing a very, corporate-driven line. For me, I've had many, many meetings with the U.S. trade negotiators, and what I've determined is that it's not worth much more of my time to continue talking to them, because they see their roles as primarily serving the interests of large corporations. What's been more interesting for me in recent years is to be meeting with both the social movements and the government representatives from other countries, especially developing countries, who've been hit hard by the global financial crisis. Many of them are rethinking their role in the global economy and are trying to push back against the U.S. approach. And so for me, that has been a very interesting area of work. And so there is a big battle going on in the TPP, with some of the developing country governments stepping up and taking a more balanced approach and really pushed to do so by the social movements in their countries. So I see that as one area of hope internationally.
So how do you see that being connected internationally and nationally? I mean, because there are many people in America, regular working people in America, who the ones who do know about TPP, because it's not been, again, the headline stories in most national nor local newspapers or TV. Mm-hmm. But people are standing up and are worried about what this means about their jobs, about food safety, about more. So how is that connection going on? How do you see it going on between here and the rest of the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're lucky to have organizations that have very strong international ties. I mean, the U.S. labor movement is working very closely, hand in hand, with their counterparts in the other 11 countries. Some relationships are closer than others, but they have put forward a common agenda that's a worker-centered agenda for international economic policies. And so to the extent that people are connected to the labor movement, that's one way to operate internationally. But also among other types of organizations, farmer organizations or family farmer organizations, not the big corporate agribusiness ones that I'm talking about, but family farmer organizations are also networked internationally and raising up a common agenda, because we're seeing that these trade agreements are not just about the rich countries against the poor countries, but they're really the corporate agenda representing the corporate elites of all of these countries against more of a people's agenda.
Again, 410-319-8888. Let me get to calls coming in to join us here. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on what is happening in America, and looking at the kind of future, looking back these 50 years and forward 50 years. And let's talk about what you all think is going to happen next. I think the victories you talk about were incredible, John, Tiffany, Sarah. But I want to kind of explore out of this coming weekend, with people coming across the nation, really to talk about where we're going. What are the battles being set up next? What are the issues and organizations that will be fighting for serious change in this country? Where's it going to come from? What do you see happening next?
Sure. Well, if I could take a first stab,
and we go to Tiffany.
John,
go ahead.
Yeah, and we're, by the way, thanks, Mark, for mentioning. We're going to be joined this weekend at this Institute for Policy Studies 50th anniversary celebration by Harry Belafonte and Barbara Ehrenreich and Katrina Vandenhoevel and many of the leaders we've been just talking about, Ajahn Poo and Sarita Gupta. And we invite all of your listeners to come and join us Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday for panels and discussions and so on. And what you'll hear a lot about this weekend and what we're pushing for is the need. A lot of the movements we're working with are trying to break the 35-year story of the right, which says that only by deregulating the economy, giving more power to big corporations, will we have prosperity. we feel the key to changing, turning things around this country, in this country, is helping people with a new story. That instead, we've got to reject that. We've got to reject 35 years of rulemaking for the big corporations and the 1%, and we need to construct a set of rules and a new economy from the bottom up that is a Main Street economy, and that's good for people and good for the planet, and that we can do it. But a key, and this is the fight over the closed-down government that we're in right now, is really a much bigger fight over the story of possibility. And at IPS, we feel centrally America is not broke. There are plenty of resources, and if we only fairly tax the wealthy and pollution, we can do it. And we're not just saying that as a dream and an imagine. America did this once before. We did it in the 50s and 60s. We pushed up tax rates on the rich. We created a vast middle class. We created a society that was good for the majority. That was taken away, and the struggle now is to create the momentum to take it back.
Tiffany, I'm curious how you see it.
Sure. I mean, what we're doing is really helping the movements organize around vision. Like John was saying, you know, just winning one victory at a time is helpful for keeping the momentum going, but it's not enough to sort of hold the hearts and minds of the workers who are struggling to get by. You know, half of these direct care workers are actually relying on public benefits, so it's not like they have a lot of time to sit around and sort of work on these campaigns. So we have to have something really compelling, and that's this vision where care workers are treated with respect, and at the same time our families can afford good quality care. So it's really focusing on what we want to see for society that keeps us going. That being said, we see the next battles as really about implementation. You know, getting a law is only the very first step. Organizing has a role here too, which is to demand that the laws are enforced.
So before we run out of time completely, let's give some information about how people can come down Saturday and Sunday and Friday and participate in what's going on. I think it would be great if people from this listening area all around here in Baltimore, Washington, Virginia, and Delaware and Pennsylvania are listening to know they can come down and take part in where it's going to be and how they do that, John.
Sure. The program is on our website, the Institute for Policy Studies website, which is ips-bc.org. A big plenary with Barbara Ehrenreich and Ai-Jen Poo and others, Jamie, your state senator, Jamie Raskin, on Friday night. A lot of the activities are in a good Union hotel near Union Station called the Liaison.
That's important.
But you get all the details on our website. And then there's a big party for people who like dancing and celebrating the victories and the future Sunday night at Union Station in the East Hall of Union Station at 8 p.m. And we'd love the activities, all that Ideas into Action Festival of Friday night and Saturday and Sunday morning are free and open to the public. So please join us.
John Kavanaugh, Sarah Anderson, and Tiffany Williams from the Institute for Policy Studies. Thanks to the three of you so much. On to the next 50 years, and see you all this weekend.
Great. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks so much, Mark.
All right. We're going to go out with a little bit more Redbone. Witch Queen of New Orleans.
Mari, Mari, da voodoo, vo. She'll put a spell on you. Mari, Mari, da voodoo, vo. She'll put a spell on you. Mari, Mari, da voodoo, vo. She's the Witch Queen of New Orleans. Of New